Good morning.
Good morning.
Please be seated. We are here this morning, at least for the first matter on our calendar, which is Aspen Financial Services versus the District Court, the real party in interest being Gregson. This is case number 58184. Mr. Bailey, Mr. Maurice, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am.
Before he does, I want to confirm that everyone got my disclosure towards the end of February.
We did receive your disclosure, and we have no problems with you proceeding in this matter.
Is that?
We received it also, Your Honor. No, Justice Pickering, no objection.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Bailey.
It pleases this honorable court. Madam Chief, Justices, John Bailey, Brandon Kimball from Bailey Kennedy, appearing on behalf of petitioners. If I may, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue before this court goes well beyond these parties. This is an issue of first impression here in the state of Nevada. This is a case to determine whether you are going to allow civil litigants in order to gain a tactical and strategic advantage in civil litigation, to actively enlist the assistance of criminal authorities, and then to turn around and assist those criminal authorities by acting as a conduit for civil litigation, namely deposition transcripts, to help those criminal authorities. All of this to the disadvantage of other civil litigants in the case, and particularly with respect to their constitutional rights. I'd like to make 3 points. The first point is the context of the case. The underlying case is simply a bad economy case. My client, Aspen, is what is generally known as a hard money lender with respect to real property. Aspen has thousands of investors, literally thousands of investors. The Gregson parties are nothing more than a handful of investors who have sued Aspen and Jeff Gwynn over their investment in what is called the Milano loan. These same investors have been investing with Aspen for over 10 years. They've always received their principal back, and they've made literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in interest on their investments. Unfortunately, for everyone, starting in 2008, the local economy in Las Vegas, and indeed in this state and in this country, started to experience a drastic and unexpected decline, and real property values plummeted. The borrower on the Milano loan defaulted, which caused the impairment of all of the investors' principal and interest. The Gregson parties then turned around and sued Aspen and Mr. Gwynn, claiming that somehow they were at fault. The ringleader of the Gregson parties, an individual by the name of Charles Thompson, and for the record, it's not the Charles Thompson that we all know as the district court judge down, the former district court judge, retired district court judge down in the 8th Judicial District. It is a different Charles Thompson who happens to be a retired lawyer. Mr. Thompson, along with his cohorts, immediately began a media campaign against Aspen and Mr. Gwynn to try to smear and malign both Aspen and Mr. Gwynn. They filed complaints with almost every regulatory agency you can think of. And when you look at the petitioner's appendix, page 454, you have the responses, the verified responses from Mr. Thompson to interrogatories.
Mr. Bailey, let me interject at this point. We have a Fifth Amendment collision here that you're asserting. And I understand from the pleadings the factual background of this. The corporate defendant really doesn't have the Fifth Amendment protection. But I understand you have officers and directors who may have that. I guess for one thing, reading through this, at least at the writing of what was submitted to the court, no one had been formally indicted to date. Is that a correct statement still of the facts?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Do we have any inclination as to whether or not we have an active criminal indictment forthcoming, or is this still a kind of a quagmire that we don't know?
We, as I stand here today, have no specific information as to what the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office is doing. What we do know is that there is some active investigation pending involving Aspen and its principals with respect to the Milano loan. And we know that this investigation started with Mr. Thompson filing complaints with regulatory agencies, the Internal Revenue Service, ultimately the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. But to answer your question directly, we don't know the status of that active investigation. All we know is that it has started. We know that the FBI has issued questionnaires to investors. And from that point forward, we don't know exactly what they're doing internally. We do know, because the Grayson Party's counsel stood up in open court and admitted that they are assisting the FBI and that they are providing the FBI with civil discovery and namely deposition transcripts, that perhaps the Grayson Parties have a greater insight because they're now in cahoots with the criminal authorities as to where that status is. But I could not tell you the status of that investigation, and you are absolutely correct. There are no indictments, to my knowledge, that have been handed down or that have been pinned.
Even though this may be a first impression case in this jurisdiction, we have other jurisdictions that tend not to support a stay if there's no indictment. Having said that, though, one of the concerns, and you voice it, is using the civil to promote the criminal. But at the outset, one of the concerns is, if we were to reverse and if we were to offer a stay, for how long? Because there's no actual criminal indictment or criminal action pending at this point.
Indeed, Justice Douglas, that is the million-dollar question. What the cases say, they don't say that there's a bright-line test, which is either you have a criminal indictment and you are entitled to a stay. Whether or not there has been a criminal indictment is only one factor amongst many, which I refer to as the Walsh factors. It's only one factor. And indeed, there is no authority across this country that says that you are only entitled to a stay if there has been a criminal indictment. Your point is well taken, which is how long would that stay be in place? The stay that we've asked for is narrowly drawn. We have not asked to stay the case. We have not asked to stay discovery. We have only asked to stay testimonial statements that would implicate our constitutional rights in terms of the scope, in terms of the limitation.
And that seems to be the crux of the issue, because as I asserted, Aspen really doesn't have that Fifth Amendment protection. So as a corporate defendant, they are kind of floating out there. The individuals, they may.
Well, the cases clearly say that when you're in peril in some manner, you certainly have your constitutional rights. You are absolutely correct when you indicate, and we all agree, that corporations do not have constitutional Fifth Amendment rights. But we also know from the case law that as a practical matter, when you have a small company and you only have a couple individuals who are able to speak on behalf of the company, and those individuals have those constitutional rights, that courts, as a practical matter, extend the stay to the corporation because, and the stay is not to stay the assertion of constitutional rights because corporations don't have them, but you stay the proceeding or the narrow scope of what you're providing to the individuals because they're the only ones who can speak on behalf of the corporation. And that's what courts have always said as a practical matter.
Mr. Bailey, a follow-up question. Number one, you indicate that the stay that you requested was limited in scope, but the record would suggest that you failed to identify other means of protecting your clients, such as seeking the sealing of records and certain of other devices that would be available to you. Question number one. Question number two, because the authorities nationwide are at best divided, what is it that you seek in terms of the state of Nevada with respect to creating a rule of law having to do with this particular Fifth Amendment dilemma?
Let me answer your first question, which is, are there some alternatives that can be implemented, such as sealing records? I have asked that same question of my client's other counsel, who is a criminal attorney. His name is Rick Wright. Mr. Wright has indicated to me that sealing records does not work because of some provision in the Supremacy Clause where federal courts are able, irrespective of sealing records, are able to still have access to documents in discovery and civil discovery. So I've asked that question, and that was the response that I received. So other than that, I don't know of any other mechanism other than to limit the scope of what you're seeking to stay in terms of trying to protect both constitutional rights and at the same time not jeopardize the tactical advantage that one is trying to gain in the civil case if you assert your rights and then you get some further limitation of your ability to testify at the time of trial or to otherwise have some kind of limiting instruction as to an adverse inference.
Mr. Bailey, before you answer the Chief's second question, because it relates to the point you just made, there are authorities in which federal courts have, as a less drastic measure, sealed discovery without contest or challenge. I don't recall any briefing that suggested that this alternative jeopardizes the your client's First or Fifth Amendment privilege. Perhaps there's supplemental briefing should be required on this point, but it does appear that there are a number of courts which have resorted to sealing as an alternative.
And that may be very true, Justice Hardesty. That question from the Chief just arose this morning.
Sure.
I did anticipate that that question might arise, and that's why I asked Mr. Wright, what about sealing the record? What about sealing depositions?
But,
and that was his response to me. We'd be happy to provide some supplemental authorities on that point if the court wishes.
Well, in fact,
and your response raises yet another implication, and that is whether or not either the Supremacy Clause or something else would permit a federal prosecution to overcome a state court sealing. We have a multifaceted or multi-level question, I think. While federal courts appear to resort to less drastic measures, we have to consider, it seems, the implication on state courts in adopting those.
And I would absolutely agree with you. Let me answer.
Now I'm going to give you a few more minutes because we've peppered you with questions, but I also want to just briefly follow up. As I recall reading the transcript in this case, some of this was actually discussed in the motion where you, on behalf of your client, although Mr. Wright was not present, you indicated that the Fifth Amendment invocation would somehow damage, you didn't want to seek anything less than a complete stay because of this very factor. Did I read that correctly? Is that
no, what we were asking for was just a stay of testimonial statements. We weren't trying to stay anything other than testimonial statements because it would be the testimonial statements that would be funneled to the FBI through the Grayson parties in a strategic way to try to get an advantage in the civil case.
Okay.
To answer your question as to why we're here seeking relief from the court and what we ask the court to do, again, this is a question of first impression here in Nevada. What we would suggest the court do is to do what is the prevailing view amongst all states who have looked at this issue, which is you identify and analyze these six factors in determining whether or not a stay is appropriate when you have a pending civil case and a parallel criminal case.
But
the first factor, of course,
parallel investigation, because we don't have a parallel criminal case.
You are correct.
Here.
A parallel criminal investigation. And the first factor, all courts have said, is the threshold question and the most important question, which is, to what extent are the issues in the civil case a part of the criminal investigation? The more they overlap, the greater the greater opportunity and the greater way in which the court should issue a stay. In our case, there's complete overlap. They're identical. They're the exact same loan. And so that's why we've said when you look at those factors and you apply those factors, the lower court got it wrong. The judge drew a bright line and said either you have been indicted or your request for a stay is not ripe. There's no authority to support that, nowhere. The authority, prevailing authority amongst all the states who have considered this is you look at these factors. And when you look at these factors, particularly even the case that the lower court judge cited, SEC versus Dressler, that case doesn't do an analysis on ripeness. That case indicates that you do a case-by-case determination, and you have a much greater case if Fifth Amendment rights are implicated, as in our situation. So we're asking the court to do two things. We're asking you to look at our particular case, use those elements, and apply them, which we believe will lead to a stay, and also to give guidance as a issue of first impression in this case as to where our state is in terms of that issue.
I have a question for you. Do you have a trial date?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a trial date?
I do not believe we have a trial date.
I know.
The case has been pending for approximately 2 years, I believe.
It was vacated after this court entered a stay of all testimony and discovery.
I'm ready for him.
And Mr. Bailey, for the record, I will reserve at least 3 minutes for you to end rebuttal because we peppered you with substantial questioning.
Thank you, Chief.
You're very welcome. Mr. Maurice.
Thank you, Justice Seda. Aaron Morris on behalf of the Real Parties in Interest. Let's just start with one of the comments Mr. Bailey made there at the very end. He said there's complete overlap between this criminal investigation and this civil lawsuit. Question, how on earth does Mr. Bailey know that? What has been presented to this court is a questionnaire that was sent to investors, and we have a statement, unsubstantiated in any way, that a subpoena was issued sometime last year by a grand jury for records. That subpoena has never been produced. Nobody knows what those records related to. This comes back to this issue. Every court that has applied the six-factor balancing test says the most important element is the overlap of the civil and criminal proceedings. To determine whether there's an overlap, a judge, the trial court judge, must take the criminal indictment and compare it to the civil complaint. That's how you determine if there's overlap. If you look at the cases that have been set forth in the briefing, they all say this is why the general rule is that pre-indictment requests for stay are denied, because it requires pure conjecture on the part of the trial court.
Well, let me ask something.
Yes.
You have a pretty good case when you filed your complaint.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
And it sounded like Mr. Bailey did make some concessions that, number one, the case was going forward, discovery was going forward. What stopped you at that point to go along with his concessions and then get an expedited trial date and then put these people on the stand and question them?
Well,
and then they could, if they take the Fifth Amendment, they're in real trouble then.
There were a number of, I mean, this is a document-intensive case. You have a failed construction project that was ultimately attempted. And we had, at the early portion of the case, we had named other defendants. A construction management service. We wanted to document where every dollar of my clients and the other investors' money went. In other words, when it went to Aspen and then went into to a account controlled by, I think it was Contract Management Services, we wanted to find out where it went to see if this was a situation where the money was embezzled on the way in, which we know it was, and on the way out in terms of going to the contractor, or just on the way in. We were able to document where every single penny went, and we ultimately dismissed the construction control agent. That's why. This was not a matter of a simple case. I was dealing with multiple law firms representing multiple parties, making multiple defenses. And like I said, in terms of Aspen, it was easy. Okay.
Besides Jeff Gwynn's deposition, what else did you want?
We want depositions of Jeff Gwynn, Sean Corrigan, the other Aspen employees. I don't know if we have additional interrogatories that need to be answered. Mr. Gwynn has not sat, and neither has Mr. Corrigan, for any deposition. They no-showed the first deposition, filed the motion for protective order, and that's how we got here. That was over a year ago. But so in terms of when Mr. Bailey says, well, they're free to proceed with any discovery they want other than testimonial discovery, I find myself sitting there saying, And what exactly, what other discovery is that? I mean, that's the position I find myself in, is saying what other, my next logical step is to depose the Aspen employees. That's the answer to that question. With regard to, one thing I need to make clear is, Mr. Bailey's in a tough spot. He stands up here. If you look at the cases, you know, all the cases say the same thing. As a general rule, pre-indictment requests for stay are denied. They all say that. Mr. Bailey directs this court to a series of cases where pre-indictment requests for stay have been granted. In other words, he points you to the exception to the general rule. The problem Mr. Bailey has is if you look at those cases, they all fall into one of three categories. They all involve situations where the government is on both tracks. In other words, I mean, he cites the SEC case. There are plenty of laws out there in the federal government which provide administrative agencies with the ability to prosecute civil claims and criminal claims. And in 1970, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Cordell decision determined that there was nothing wrong about a federal agency prosecuting both civil cases and criminal cases based on the same violation. They can do it at the same time. The vast majority of the cases that deal with pre-indictment stays are cases in which the federal government is on both sides. In other words, you've got a U.S. attorney's office where the guy in office 1A is prosecuting the criminal action and the guy in office 1B is prosecuting the civil action. And in those instances, the courts have said, you know, this is a problem. The likelihood of abuse of this process is just too attractive for these federal prosecutors. That's the first category of cases. Obviously, we don't have that here.
Abuse of the process in what respect? Sharing information?
Pardon?
Abuse of the process in what respect?
In that respect, it is use of the civil discovery by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the civil case, depositions, interrogatories, and then handing those over to the criminal.
Isn't that exactly what you want here?
No, because I don't represent the FBI. That's one of the interesting things.
Right, but your clients are actually giving the information that's coming out of the civil discovery to prompt a criminal investigation. And obviously seeking an indictment beyond that.
Well, there's a huge difference between contacting the authorities and working for the authorities. What the courts have found is...
But what is the policy difference?
Well, the policy difference is there would be active coordination between a federal prosecutor representing on the criminal side and a federal prosecutor working on the civil side. You don't have that here.
You have a facilitator here, though, that accomplishes essentially the same thing.
You know, I don't think you do. And I think it's interesting. It's not the fact that a deposition taken in the civil context may end up in the hands of a federal prosecutor. That's not it. It's the fact that in that stream of cases, you have a situation where a criminal prosecutor can draft out all the questions that he wants to ask but can't ask, hand those over to the guy in the office next to him, and have him go do so in a civil case. And in that instance, that's a situation where some courts have recognized the right to a pre-indictment stay of discovery.
But Mr. Morris, whether we have a government agent in the form of a civil U.S. attorney handing over information to a criminal U.S. attorney, we have the same result here. I think that point has been made, at least in terms of policy. We have information being passed from a civil proceeding into a criminal. My question goes back to where you started your argument, and it has to do with you disputed the fact that Mr. Bailey's client alleges that these two proceedings lay right on top of one another. And then you took that and you went so far as to say, and, of course, all the law says that unless and until you can say that these are parallel or overlapping cases, you know, you really can't get into the middle of it. Well, in my mind, that also is a bit disingenuous because that clearly strikes a rule that would have to say unless and until you have either two government agencies, criminal and civil, acting together, the SEC and the criminal, or an indictment, you can never protect your clients from that perspective.
No, because there are two other categories that those pre-indictment cases fall into. The first one I've already touched on, you just mentioned, where you have the government on both sides, on both tracks. The second one is where, although you don't have an indictment, indictments of co-conspirators have already been handed down, and there has been some assurance provided, usually in the form of correspondence from a U.S. attorney, or in some instances, the judge presiding over the grand jury, who has written a letter, signed an affidavit to the district court judge that says, yes, there is an overlap, indictments are imminent. That's the second situation. And then the third situation is where there's no objection. And there are some instances where actually the civil litigant joins in the motion. They don't want to proceed with the civil case until the criminal case is over. Those are the three scenarios in which you see pre-indictment requests for stay being granted. We don't fall in any of those.
Rule would then require us to be this far away from indictment or in indictment or have two government agencies working together.
Correct, because think of what would happen if it were otherwise. You would have the new form objection throughout the state of Nevada to any deposition notice would be, my client reasonably believes he's under criminal investigation. That would be the new form objection that would be provided any time. And how would you refute that?
And a lot of times the federal government will not reveal whether you're under investigation. Believe me, I know that.
Exactly.
As a criminal defense attorney.
And one of the issues that comes up, the reason why, again, the general rule is pre-indictment requests for stay are denied is,
or just
the indictment is handed down, then the defendant's right to a speedy trial at least provides the civil litigants with some assurance that this matter is going to be handled in a relatively speedy way. You can gauge the length or the duration, pardon me, of the stay. In our situation, we don't. It's not like the FBI is sending out status letters saying our investigation is proceeding well. We expect to have indictments or expect to stop our investigation in another 2 months. We don't have anything like that. Nobody knows what that investigation is even about. Mr. Bailey seems to believe it's about the Milano loan. I have a different belief. We don't have any information that tells us specifically what this investigation is about, when it's going to be concluded, what the likelihood of an indictment is.
So there's no target letters out?
I don't know. That's a question for Mr. Bailey. I have a feeling if there was a target letter, we would have seen it as an exhibit.
Have your clients checked on whether the statute of limitations as to what the federal government could indict these folks for?
We have not. Mr. Bailey wants to make it sound like I'm a junior G-man and my clients are actively working with the FBI. If you actually look at the citations that are provided, it's a gross overstatement. I mean, he basically takes...
Wasn't this information brought to their attention by your clients?
Which information?
What's this investigation is about? They submitted that information to start with?
My clients, well, I think it was one client specifically, was dropping off information at the front desk of the FBI office.
All right,
I have no idea what happened with it. The next thing I knew is I got a phone call from an FBI agent named Steve Conrad, and I don't do criminal law, so when an FBI agent calls my office, I pick it up. He said, my understanding is you've deposed Susan Mardian. Can I have a copy of that transcript? I sat there, thought about it. I don't represent Susan Mardian.
Let me follow up then, though. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has issued a five-factor test in Keating. I'd like to hear your comments about that. I'd also like to hear your comment about Dresser and looking at special circumstances as to why you should or shouldn't grant a stay and looking at it as Mr. Bailey. And lastly, did you, as the trial date was vacated, did you request a expedited new setting of a trial date under these circumstances since we are in a state that has a five-year rule?
No, we did not. Your Honor, this case was essentially, I described this court's order, putting a stay on all testimonial discovery is essentially the hand of God came in and stopped our case. Our case was in the process of being prepared, and it was stopped. I mean, that's what happened.
Well, it interrupted.
Pardon?
It interrupted.
Interrupted. But at the point that I was at, I didn't need to send out more requests for productions. I didn't need to do more document analysis. I needed to depose the witnesses who were going to be taking the stand in this case. And that's what I needed to do. Mr. Bailey's office knew it. They did everything they could to stop it. With regard to Dressler, that's a classic case of government on both sides. It's the SEC versus Dressler. Those are the special circumstances. You don't have that in this case. The three situations you'd be looking for is government on both sides of the civil and criminal cases. You don't have that here. I don't represent the government. The second one is where you have co-conspirators who have already been indicted and some kind of representation to the court that indictments are imminent. You don't have that here. My understanding is the Mardians haven't been indicted. I have no reason to believe that Mr. Bailey's statement with regard to the fact that no indictments have been handed down is improper. We have no idea about the status of that investigation. And then the third one is where the civil litigant, in fact, either joins in the motion or doesn't oppose the motion. And that's clearly not the case because my clients are all in their retirement age. This was their retirement. These were their retirement funds that were lost. We oppose the motion. One thing I need to touch on.
Mr. Morris, yes. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Well, one other thing I wanted to do, and this was actually where I wanted to start this discussion. This court has recognized, as have all courts, that a district court judge has discretion over his calendar. He has the ability to speed cases up. He has the ability to stay cases. That's all Judge Denton did in this situation. Judge Denton looked at the authority that he had in the state of Nevada and determined that because there was no indictment, the request for stay was not ripe, therefore he was denying it. That was a discretionary act. This court has recognized repeatedly that writs of mandamus, writs of prohibition, should not be used where all the district court judge did was engage in a discretionary act. So what I wanted to say was, even if this court decides it is time for Nevada to adopt the multi-factor balancing test, even if this court wants to make new law today, make it clear that Meyer doesn't apply and adopt a whole new line of authority, it still doesn't change the fact that what you have here is a pre-indictment request. And if this court is in its pronouncement of a new standard, if at the same time it adopts and endorses this idea that a pre-indictment stay, where none of those three factors that are common amongst all the other cases are employed, it's gonna be the biggest slippery slope you've ever seen. I mean, because how hard is it to say, I believe I'm under investigation? Every case that has a fraud allegation could result in a civil litigant saying, I don't have to be deposed. I believe I'm under criminal investigation for this. Justice Hardison?
It seems to me that a rule that limits your ability to proceed in your case, in the civil case, is unfair to civil litigants, especially aged civil litigants. If the government is improperly engaging in discovery communications with your clients, then the criminal defendant will have the opportunity to point that out when the government prosecutes them.
Well, it's interesting. What the Cordell decision, going back to 1970, and Justice Ginsburg's opinion says is, there's nothing wrong with the government availing itself of every investigative opportunity it has. That was a really difficult situation where one branch of the prosecutor's office served interrogatories on a party, told them it was confidential, this will never come back to bite you, they sign it, submit it, they slide it across to the next office, and the next thing you know, they're being prosecuted for what was in those interrogatories. The court says, in terms of the federal investigators, they're allowed to go out and avail themselves of those kind of sources.
Which leads to my next question that I posed to Mr. Bailey. Other courts have recognized less drastic measures than an outright stay, such as sealing certain portions of civil discovery, like, for example, some of the people you want to depose here. Instead of engaging in a frequent exchange of objections over whether the question invokes or evokes testimonial statements, it could just as easily have sealed that. The question is whether or not the defendant's, or at least that party's, Fifth Amendment privilege will be protected under a state sealing order. And that hasn't been briefed in this case.
And I do not know the answer to that. That would clearly be an argument that Mr. Bailey would be making on behalf of his clients. I don't plan on doing discovery for the federal government. I plan on doing discovery for my civil lawsuit to satisfy my clients. The fact that the result of that...
Well, it seems to me the district court in this case didn't consider, and I'm not being critical of the judge, I'm just saying it didn't appear to me that these alternatives were not evaluated, and that a bright-line test was adopted in the order that he entered, the bright-line test being no indictment, no stay.
I would agree with the... I don't believe that Mr. Bailey advanced the position as anything short of a stay would be satisfactory.
But he's arguing and representing to us today that all he sought a stay of was testimonial statements by his client. There are many things that his clients could testify to in a deposition that would not be protected by the Fifth Amendment privilege. You know that.
Right. And that was my point at the hearing in front of Judge Denton was, let me ask the questions. If they want to assert their Fifth Amendment rights, I'm obviously not saying that they cannot. I have to respect the invocation of the privilege as much as anybody. They didn't even want to sit for the questions. I mean, that was the, right. They didn't even want to, their argument was, the negative connotations that would be that would result from their clients taking the Fifth Amendment into response to certain questions.
Which is why some courts have considered the sealing alternative.
And I just don't believe that was – nobody ever requested that of Judge Denton. I certainly didn't request
it. If we're examining what the law in Nevada should be, is that a tool that should be in the district court's toolbox?
Because I'm not familiar with the research, my fear is, based on the Cordell case, is that even if a district court judge entered an order that said this is sealed, that the federal prosecutors would just march right through that. That's just my impression from Cordell. I could be completely wrong. I'm just speaking
and
about my view.
In fact, that matter was not before Judge Denton, correct?
Correct. Again.
But how could a state court, and I guess we're addressing issues that sort of on the fly here, but how could a state court say this will not be deemed a waiver of your Fifth Amendment privilege? I mean, the federal government would then take the position that by testifying, Mr. Bailey's clients have waived their Fifth Amendment protections.
Well,
and that's their point, is that it gives away the store when they invoke the privilege. Even that invocation is significant, but to the extent they do testify and provide testimony, they would have waived any Fifth Amendment privilege associated with that testimony.
Right. I disagree with that. The idea that just because a person sits and offers testimony means that they have waived their Fifth Amendment privilege in a civil case, I don't agree with that.
As to the privilege, as to what they testify to, they surely have.
Correct. If I ask Mr. Gwynn, what is your name, and he says, my name is Jeff Gwynn, he has waived the privilege with respect to that.
That's my point.
And if I say, did you conspire with Susan Mardian to defraud my clients out of $7.6 million, and he says, I take the Fifth Amendment and decline to answer, he has preserved his privilege with respect to that question. So I don't think that changes anything. I think the fact is he needs to sit for the deposition, answer those questions which do not call for him to make a criminal admission, and invoke for those that do call for him to make a criminal admission. He will have preserved the privilege for the criminal case. I mean, obviously, there's nothing in the Fifth Amendment.
And a sealing order would then a sealing order would dismantle his argument if the feds respected it, that by answering some questions and invoking as to others, that in and of itself would be a tell to the government of what the sensitive areas are. A sealing order might protect that.
A sealing order might. Again, I don't know if it – I just have not looked at that.
Richard Wright would be very upset because his clients – your clients could certainly sit in a deposition, and then when they testify in the criminal case, they're going to have some real good inside information they wouldn't have otherwise. Even if it's sealed.
Again, that's presuming that criminal investigation is about the Milano loan. My understanding is it's much broader than that.
And finally, and Mr. Bailey, there will be additional time added because we spent additional time with Mr. Morris. Finally, the question I have trails Justice Pickering's question, and it is, if in fact an invocation of Fifth Amendment protections is made in the civil case, can that not be used in an adverse instruction against the civil Mr. Bailey's clients in the subsequent proceeding?
In a civil case, yes. I mean, under Meyer, they have a choice. This court recognized it's a difficult choice.
So it becomes meaningless. The invocation of the right almost becomes meaningless because eventually it's going to get used against you regardless.
But it's going to keep you out of jail. The Fifth Amendment is designed to keep you out of jail. It's not designed to keep you from losing a civil judgment for your fraudulent conduct.
Thank you.
Before you sit down, you indicated that you wanted to do these depots. Was there any other outstanding discovery that your client has not done because of the holding up of these depots, number one? Number two, in the discussion before the district court, did they talk about other alternatives and, more importantly, prejudice to your client if this does not go forward as affecting the trial date?
I made the argument that this would be prejudicial to my clients. I think I made an offhanded reference to the fact that the average age of my clients is about 74 and a half. This was their retirement savings. They are in their golden years. You know, this needs to proceed forward.
I understood that from looking at the record, but I didn't see any specific detriment to any of your clients that got made except these general.
Absolutely. It is nothing more than a general statement that I represent an older group of clients who invested their retirement funds with Aspen, and that is the subject of the dispute.
But our legislature has adopted a statute that places a priority on cases in which litigants are aged. So we have a public policy in this state that recognizes that older litigants have a right to an expedited trial.
Correct, Justice Hardesty. And until this court entered its order staying testimonial discovery, I was on track, I believe, for it was either a March or February trial date. I think it was about 2 weeks ago because we entered into a stipulation.
But are your client? I'm sorry to prolong this. Are your clients even at the legislative threshold for expedited trial setting?
In terms of their age, I would definitely have at least one client who would qualify for that.
Thank you.
I'd like to confirm one final point, and I think Justice Douglas confirmed it already, but I want to make sure. The offer that you would only limit the stay to testimonial discovery is no help to you because, as I understand you, you have completed all of your document discovery, and all that remains is deposition discovery with respect to those documents to ready the case for trial. Is that fair?
Correct, Justice Pickering, with one exception. As you know, sometimes when you take the depositions of certain people, you learn about new avenues for information. So it's very possible that I could take the depositions of the Aspen employees and find that there are additional documents that I want to request either from them through request for production. There might be additional interrogatories I want to send with regard to figures that I need them to provide, and there might be third-party discovery that needs to occur. But as of this point, I do not know of any other than the depositions of the Aspen employees that I need.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Bailey, although a bit unusual because this is the time set aside for rebuttal, I'm going to give you 2 minutes to occupy your time with completing your argument that you would have made initially, and then 3 minutes for rebuttal.
And just to say, if I could ask, well, I haven't asked any questions today. I just had one, the whole thing for Mr. Bailey, is on the case of Francis versus Wynn Las Vegas, which the court decided October 6, 2011. I just ask how that plays into your argument in this particular case, if at all, if you feel it's applicable.
I'm not sure it does at all, Justice Gibbons. In fact, that's not a case that either party cited.
It was not decided before your briefing was completed.
That's correct. Right.
That's why I asked the question, because it's relatively recent.
You're obviously thinking of something of how that case might implicate.
Well, it's a whole Fifth Amendment analysis here, even though it was a request to reopen discovery after invoking the Fifth Amendment, and the court said that couldn't be done. But I just wondered if any of the language in there, if you thought it had any implications in this case.
Okay. Let me try to very quickly clear up a couple things, because Chief Justice Sada, you asked the question about the overlap and whether or not there's truly an overlap between the criminal investigation and the civil case. The civil case only deals with the Milano loan. The criminal investigation absolutely deals with the Milano loan, and we know that from looking at the record, petitioner's appendix, and I will tell you the pages, 453 through 455, 459, 463, 465, and 467. In fact, on page 496 of petitioner's appendix, we have the questionnaire that went to the investors. And question number 5, did you invest in a loan commonly known as the Milano loan? So there is clearly no question about the identical overlap between the civil case, which is only dealing with the Milano loan, and the FBI's investigation, which was initiated as a trial strategy and tactic to try to put us in this position and gain unfair advantage. Now, to suggest that because Mr. Morris is not a G-man does not answer the question, I think, as Justice Pickering said or Justice Perigary said. They are actively providing information to the criminal authorities. In fact, Mr. Thompson is a former district attorney. Does that help them in putting us in the corner? Now, one of the questions that was asked was, well, why don't you just go to a deposition and pick and choose which questions you want to assert your constitutional rights to? First of all, doesn't that beg the question? Once you asserted the right, you're already in trouble in the civil context because you're going to get the adverse inference. That's why we're here. That's the specific reason as to why we're here. We're put in a corner, in a dilemma of either saying, now, let me start by saying, my clients want to testify. We want to go through with the civil case. My clients are saying to me, we're absolutely innocent. We haven't done anything. Let us testify. Of course, Mr. Wright, and I'm sure Justice Jerry would understand this, Mr. Wright says, I'm your criminal counsel. I'm not going to let you testify. You hired me to give you advice. I'm not going to let you testify because we know there is a pending criminal investigation, and the Gregson parties are actively assisting that criminal investigation. Even innocent, truthful statements can be taken in the wrong direction when you're dealing with the criminal authorities.
Well, could you, though, address why appearing for deposition and invoking the privilege in response to questions that trench on arguably protected Fifth Amendment rights is not adequate in this situation? I mean, you're the movement for a protective order. The judge exercised his discretion and declined it across the board, but in an attorney-client privilege, for example, just because I want to take the deposition of a lawyer doesn't mean I can't take the deposition at all. Usually you would go forward and the lawyer would assert privilege, et cetera. What is wrong with that approach here, a question-by-question approach?
The problem is, Justice Pickering, that we are going to get to questions where criminal counsel will say to my client, you need to invoke your constitutional rights. And once you invoke your constitutional rights, you have now set up the other side to go to court and say, we want a limiting order where they can't testify on that subject matter because they've invoked their constitutional rights. And we want a jury instructions indicating that a negative inference can be drawn from the fact that they've asserted their constitutional rights. That's the problem. That's why instead of putting ourselves in that position.
The pushback problem is, though, you're balancing a civil rule of 26C or whatever it is, where your opponent's clients also have rights to discovery and to get their case to trial and to vindicate or lose the claims they're asserting against your client. And so there's a balancing going on there. And
absolutely.
My concern is to just shut the door to deposition discovery completely without trying to strike a middle ground delays their case, and it protects your client, but what does it do for them? Is there any middle ground here that could or should be struck?
You have correctly put your finger on the most difficult part of this, which is the middle ground. Now, the cases say that you look at the circumstances, and when you issue a stay, particularly for testimonial statements, you do that only for the limited period of time in which you know that there's some active investigation going on. Of course, we have a difficulty here because, at least from our perspective, maybe they know because they're cooperating with the government as to what the government is doing. So you're correct that the middle ground is difficult, but you don't put my clients at risk when they started this as a tactical advantage in the case and then let them benefit from it by saying, well, even though you started this and you're a conduit for the government in providing civil discovery they wouldn't get under criminal procedure, you are now going to put us in the position of having to make that choice. And that is a very difficult middle ground. And all we're saying is, don't put us in that position. We want it just a limited scope of discovery, and we only want it until the duration of the criminal investigation has come to some conclusion.
See, and that's where I think Justice Hardesty's sealing order merits some contemplation by the court and the parties.
And I don't disagree with that. I think that's a brilliant approach. I contemplated that myself when I asked Mr. Wright about it, and perhaps further briefing on that point would be appropriate. If we could ensure that participating in a deposition in the civil context could not be used by the criminal authorities in their investigation or proceeding, and there was some certainty about that, I wouldn't have a problem with it. I can't speak for Mr. Wright, but as a civil litigator, I certainly would have no problem with it. I don't have a problem with my clients testifying now. They want to testify. The truth helps them in this case. And by the way, the person who started all this, Mr. Thompson, since this petition has been filed, He has dismissed each and every claim against Aspen and Jeff Gwynn with prejudice without receiving any compensation, recognizing that his claims have no merit. That's where we stand. And all we're asking you to do is to, on this issue of first impression, is to set forth the standard. It's the balancing test, the six factors that everyone uses. It's not a bright line test. It's not a, if you've been indicted, then you have a right issue regarding stay. It's a balancing test. And we ask you to set forth that balancing test. And when you look at it in the terms of what we have in our case, we believe that you will issue a limited stay because it's appropriate. We should not, as a trial tactic, be put in a position of choosing between hurting ourselves in the civil case and allowing them to be a conduit for the federal government.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. This matter will stand submitted.